possible elements might bind diverse groups, like fundamentalist Muslims, fundamentalist Christians, secular Chinese people, and the rest of the pluralistic world. Someone who'd heard my comments on the role of Islam in the UK law, should the Christian church play a greater role in the justice system? What's the role of missions for the future of Christianity? Should their emphasis be on social welfare or preaching the gospel? Do you believe there is such a thing as productive interfaith dialogue? And do you think that only through accepting the claim of the gospels in Jesus will we be able to fully realize perspective giving and intimacy? Or do you think there are other ways to come to these understandings? Right. Let me take the last two of those to start with. Is there such a thing as productive interfaith dialogue? Well, the short answer is yes. I've experienced it many times with Jews, with Muslims, with Buddhists, particularly, and with some others too. And what I define as productive interfaith dialogue is not an attempt to negotiate a position that nobody recognizes as their own, but to understand where each person is coming from, to be open to the possibility that you might emerge from the dialogue knowing more about God than when you started, which doesn't mean being converted to the other person's point of view necessarily. And I believe also that good interfaith dialogue helps you clarify a bit what are the possibilities and what are the limits of action together in our society, which is related to one of the other questions about what possible elements might bind groups together. Now, the examples there, what might bind fundamentalist Muslims, fundamentalist Christians, and secular Chinese, and the rest of the world, I'm afraid I haven't got a short set of elements that will solve that one. And that means my chances of the Nobel Peace Prize are much reduced. But let me say this. In what's now several years of experience of dialogue with both Jews and Muslims in fairly intense and sustained ways, I've come to believe not that we have X, Y, and Z in common and A, B, and C that divide us. I've come to realize we do start from very different places, we end in very different places, and yet there is, behind all of it, a very strong sense that we see human beings in a comparable way. We see human beings as capable of receiving the will of God as an imperative and a possibility. Human beings as given responsibility. And that's quite something. We don't see the process of that revelation in the same way. We don't see the precise demands upon us in the same way. And yet we have some sense of a human dignity, which I think is not trivial. And do I think that only through accepting the claims of the Gospels? Well, I suppose, finally, the reason why I'm a Christian is that I believe that it is in that relationship that human beings will most fully come to what God purposes for them. That's why I'm a Christian. Does God regard himself as bound by that? That's for God to say. Are there evidences of lives of creativity, holiness, and excellence outside the boundaries of the Christian church? Yes. Don't let's delude ourselves about that. Does that mean that the grace and gift of God is around in places where I haven't expected to see it? Yes, of course it does. Jesus had quite a bit to say about Samaritans in his own day, and some of what Jews said about Samaritans and what some Christians say about Muslims these days are no doubt not all that different. And yet, I can't get away from the fact that the gospel lays before me what I regard as a coherent and credible and, sorry about the alliteration, compelling vision of human beings becoming human in that relationship with Jesus. That's what I believe I've been given and what I must witness to. And what God is doing outside that relationship say, I'm not God, so I leave it to him. Should the Christian church play a greater role in the justice system? I think one of the things I was trying to say a couple of weeks ago, with limited success, and indeed, as someone remarked earlier, limited common sense, no doubt, is that a good society is one which understands that people have lots of overlapping allegiances. And that while everybody may be a subject of the law of the land, that's not the only thing about them. And the law of the land, when it's working well, is working with, not against, those commitments and loyalties that, as a matter of fact, hold people together, which sometimes are as strong as religious law, and sometimes are just a matter of association and habit. So I would like to see, in a well-functioning society, a universal law that, as I think I said in the lecture a couple of weeks ago, guarantees fundamental liberties for absolutely everybody, with access for absolutely everybody, but that is prepared to ask where conscientious exceptions should be made, where local customary or religious methods of conflict resolution might be supported by the law of the land, and so on. And I think that does apply to Christian culture and law and morals as to Islamic. And the role of missions for the future of Christianity, should their emphasis be on social welfare or preaching the gospel? Both. Because preaching the gospel is preaching, proclaiming that human beings are immeasurably worthwhile in God's eyes. So worthwhile that the life of God in the flesh, the life of Christ, is poured out for the sake of everybody. God so loved the world that he gave his only son, says the fourth gospel. In other words, preaching the gospel is saying human beings are more worthwhile than you could ever begin to imagine. And if that's the case, the social implications and the political implications are immense. And most of our world is not organized on the basis that human beings are massively worthwhile. The Archbishop of York and I spent a couple of hours this afternoon in the detention center in Oakington. And that is why I feel I want to say rather strongly this evening that quite a bit of our society and our world is not organized on the basic vision that human beings are infinitely worthwhile. I can say that. Now, here are a couple of questions, if I may, about the Bible and the New Testament. If you decide to ignore parts of the Bible which clash with modern ideas of equality and human rights, do you undermine its primacy as part of Christian belief? Does this mean that you believe some parts of the Bible are not divinely inspired? I don't think we ought to ignore any parts of the Bible, and I certainly don't think that modern ideas of equality and human rights are God-given and obvious. How we read the Bible's vision of human rights and responsibilities in our contemporary social context is always a bit of a challenge, and it's shifted by bit across the centuries. To take the obvious example, it took us quite a while as Christians to notice that slavery didn't sit very easily alongside the gospel. But I don't think that for all those centuries Christians were being biblical and suddenly acquired a notion of equality and human rights that taught them slavery was wrong. I think they just started reading their Bibles a bit more carefully. And so I don't think there is that absolute opposition. I think I see where the question's coming from. And as I say, I don't think we ought simply to take slogans about equality in the modern sense as obvious, unarguable. We need to bring them face to face with what Scripture says, but be prepared to be surprised by what Scripture says. I see what you mean, says somebody else, about genuine faith being openness to more than we have yet seen or known. How do you marry this with the New Testament call to guard the deposit of faith? How do exploration and authority stand together, or can they? Very good question, that. The deposit of faith in the New Testament is, I think, first and foremost, the memory of Jesus and the witness to the fact that he is contemporary. That is, the memory of his ministry and cross, the witness to his resurrection. That's what has to be guarded, transmitted, made real in life after life after life, generation after generation after generation. And because, sorry, it's the fourth gospel again, St. John says that the whole world could not contain all the books that could be written about Jesus, I take it that the New Testament also says, in that process of passing on the memory of Jesus and the witness of the resurrection, there will be more and more to discover, more depths. There's a great 18th century Welsh hymn which speaks of the mystery of God as a sea to swim in, not to cross over. That'll do for me. How do we as Christians effectively show this loving vision to the world? Well, how long have you got? I can tell you how we don't. We don't show that loving vision by presenting to the world an image of people who are constantly monitoring one another with such hostile anxiety that people can't see in us a fundamental gratitude and generosity. And from age to age, the church has sadly got stuck in that anxious monitoring of one another. So that we may not quite know where we are, but we're absolutely sure where they are. And the famous story of the old Scots lady who decided to found her own church comes to mind. You probably know this one. And the local Presbyterian minister came to visit her and said, "Are you quite sure that only you and your coachman are going to heaven?" Which was the only membership the church had got. And the old lady thought for a while and said, "Well, I'm not so sure about Jock." So that's one way we don't do it. I think the way we most effectively show loving vision is by going on behaving as if change were possible, as if change for the better were possible, as if it were not a fiction or a fantasy to think that peace and justice and reconciliation could happen. Who are the people that the world looks to as hopeful signs of our time? Well, I may be prejudiced as an Anglican, but I do think Desmond Tutu is pretty high up in most people's list. And why is that? It's partly because he shows that change in the direction of justice, reconciliation, forgiveness, actually are not fantasies. Now, that's quite a good place to start, I think. Ooh, a couple of others.
Doing fine.
A couple of others rather scattered, but they seem to be just interesting. I wanted to pick them up. In the sense that science can help us master the world, is it, in your words, a form of terrible religion? Well, actually, yes. I think a scientific worldview which says the purpose of science is the exhaustive mastery of our environment is both bad science and bad religion. It's a form of religion. It starts with a massive world-conquering confidence that it can wrestle human limitation to the ground. And I don't think that's a particularly good place for scientific work to be, and most serious scientists wouldn't want to go there. And it's certainly a form of bad religion. Mastery is a very double-edged word, isn't it? The mastery of our circumstances, meaning it helps us to have some control over the circumstances in which we live, so that we're not passive and helpless. Okay. Mastery in the sense of containing and enslaving the environment we're in, so that we are never surprised by it and never at a loss in the face of it. I think there's something deeply inhuman about that, and deeply unreal. Modern Western society doesn't, as a corporate body, recognize its need for God. It does, however, seem to acknowledge a great deal of boredom and restlessness. In what ways do you think the gospel can offer a compelling response or alternative to the modern experience of boredom. When I preach sermons to young confirmation candidates, I do sometimes, I'm afraid, say, sooner or later somebody is going to have to let you into the terrible secret, church can be boring. Get used to it. A degree of boredom is part of your humanity. Don't expect that being human means being constantly entertained. But putting that on one side, though it's a warning worth heeding. I think my sense of the great saints of the church, the really great Christians that you come across from time to time, is that they are capable of what the spiritual tradition calls the practice of the presence of God, the sacrament of the present moment. That moment by moment, you're aware of yourself and your surroundings and somehow shot through with gift, with generosity. And moment by moment, you just open yourself to that reality. And that doesn't mean you're in a constant state of ecstasy, you know, following Thomas, skipping along and saying, hello clouds, hello sky. It simply means that what's before you is itself. God's gift, God's being somehow radiates in it. And you move from moment to moment with a sense of welcome. What else can one say? A sense of welcome. And maybe that's what most overcomes boredom. But how to get that across as a sort of cultural program, I'm not at all sure. There's a question here about climate change. Do I have any thoughts about the way in which climate change and its connection to the movement of Western civilization may affect the way religion has historically conceived of human beings in the world? Well, a very good question. And I think already we're seeing in the world of religious faith, especially Christian faith, a degree of, what shall I say, embarrassment about the way in which bad religion has prevailed to such an extent that we have been seduced into thinking the world's there to be squeezed and used by us and no more. And I think over the last 40 or 50 years, gradually, the emphasis has begun to shift for a lot of religious people. And I think it will shift still more, and it needs to. We need to be back in touch with that dimension of religious commitment, which, as I said just now, looks at our environment with the spirit of welcome, not what can I get out of this, but what's the gift I need to receive from this person or this bit of the environment just being the way it is? What can I receive from that? And a few more scattered ones, but interesting in various ways. Here are two very simple and very tough questions, which don't relate very much to what I said, but I'd feel a bit cowardly if I didn't read them out. What do the Gospels teach about homosexuality? Is it an affliction to be healed? And secondly, is Sharia law a product of terrible religion? Neither the Gospels nor the New Testament as a whole have a teaching about homosexuality as an orientation, as far as I can see. In the Gospels, Jesus is very clear about certain kinds of sexual behavior being inadmissible for his followers. He doesn't mention homosexuality specifically, though he may take it for granted. St. Paul, at the beginning of Romans, famously has quite a bit to say about the perversion of what he calls natural heterosexual desire into homosexual desire, and regards the practice of that desire as a sign of human failure. The question with which the church is wrestling at the moment is how to map all of that onto people's experience and understanding today of homosexual orientation and behavior. I'm not one of those who thinks you just tear up what the Bible says and move on. Equally, I'm not convinced that we fully understand how to put those things together. And that, of course, is why the Anglican Church is in such a muddle about all this at the moment. And if I knew how to cut the Gordian knot overnight, once again, I'd be very glad for a quick solution. I can only say that's where we are. But I don't think that the Bible gives us much ground simply for regarding homosexual orientation as an affliction to be healed. It says quite a lot of other things about homosexual behaviour. So Paul takes it for granted that it's sinful. But I don't think we can get much about the orientation as such. As for Sharia law, well, once again, I think what I was trying to say the other day was Sharia law is a very, very wide-ranging scheme of legal understanding within historic Islam. It's rooted in the sense of doing God's will in the ordinary things of life. In some of the ways in which it's been codified and practiced across the world, it has been appalling. And in some of the ways in which it's practiced now, in terms of the punishments inflicted and the attitudes to women encoded in places like Saudi Arabia, it's grim. But to judge Sharia in its entirety by that is really rather like judging the Bible by a couple of chapters on the genocide of the Canaanites, let's say, from the Old Testament. We need a bit of perspective on this. And my doomed enterprise the other day was to try and introduce a bit of that perspective. Let that be a warning to you all. Feeds the life of faith when it keeps alive that sense of the depth of things, the unseen depth of things, whether it's the depth of human relations and emotions in drama, fiction, or the depth of the visual world in the visual arts, that sense that there's always more to it. I think the phrase I used a few years ago writing about this was the religious dimension of art is recognizing that everything is more than it is, gives more than it has a resource, a dimension to it that we don't otherwise see. And understanding something about the world of art just habituates us to living in a world which is strange, not a world that's capturable and containable. Although that's good for us as well. But is faith, writes someone else, a fruit of our desire or renunciation? Brilliant question. Somebody in the Faculty of Divinity, I'd like to see it. Well, the fascinating thing, I suppose, is that faith is both the end of all our desiring, it's where all our deepest longings and emotions are converging. And at the same time, we're told, when you get to that point of deepest convergence, you can expect it to be like nothing you've ever imagined. Renunciation. So I'm afraid it's a very Anglican answer, both. We can't understand faith at all unless we understand that it is about desire. It's about eros, about longing, about the yearning for beauty, love, relation, intimacy. And you can't read a word of any religious text without seeing that. And yet, the worst thing that can happen to us, it's sometimes said, is to get our heart's desire. As if I were to write, what would make me happy fill in the form, hand it in to the Holy and Mysterious. And the Holy and Mysterious, instead of being Holy and Mysterious, said to me, okay, you can have exactly what you want, no more, no less. And what I would miss out on was all that I hadn't known I wanted, all that I had never known I desired. It's why, if you excuse the analogy, computer dating is a bad analogy for faith. We need to be surprised, and if we want to be surprised, we need to do a bit of renunciation, letting go of our attempt to master the future. Same thing, you see, it's the old ego again, trying to get on top of things. And renouncing that, saying, okay, I have to let go of what I think I want from God, what I think I want God to be like. I have to let God be God. Every serious Christian writer, I think, has sort of taken that for granted and spelled it out. And it's what the great masters of contemplation and mistresses of contemplation are always talking about. And last, you spoke of the difficulties of ego. Is there a particularly hard battle to be fought in this respect, surrounded by the ceremony and importance of your office? Individuals, not as archbishops, as individuals, as a church corporately. Otherwise, we are.